Chapter 8. Harm's Way. The first trick a political officer of the commissariat learns is, learn to lie. The second is, trust no one. The third, never get involved with local politics. Commissar General Delaine Oktar, from his Epistles to the Hyakins. Processions of ministerium priests, the high faithful of the imperial cult, moved through the stone vaults of Inner Hab Collective Medical Hall 67 MV. They carried tapers and smoking censers, and chanted litanies of salvation and blessing for the wounded and dying, now engulfing the place. Long, frail strips of parchment, inscribed with the speeches of the Emperor, trailed behind them like sloughs of snakeskin, dangling from the prayer boxes they carried. Surgeon Anna Kurth nodded respectfully to the clerics each time she encountered them in the wards and hallways of the medical facility, but privately she cursed them. They were in the way, and they terrified some of the weaker or more critically injured who saw them as soul-catchers come to draw them from this life. Spiritual deliverance was all very well, but there was a physical crisis at hand, one in which any able personnel would help more by tending the bodies rather than the spirits. The Zoikan assault had brought convoys of new casualties to all the inner hive medical halls, places already barely coping with the sick and injured refugees from the first phase of the conflict. Military field hospitals and medical stations were being set up to help, and the medical officers and staff that had arrived with the Imperial Guard forces were proving to be invaluable. Kurth and her colleagues were community medics with vast experience in every walk of life, except combat injuries. It was evening on the 13th day, and Kurth had been on duty for nearly 20 hours. After the nightmare of the storm assault the previous night, the fighting had slowed, with nothing more than random exchanges of shelling from both sides across the litter of Zoikan dead outside the wall. Or so Kurth had heard from passing soldiers and administratum officials. She'd barely had time to raise her head above the endless work. She paused to scrub her hands in a water bath, partly to clean them, but mainly to feel the refreshingly cold liquid on her fingers. She looked up to see groups of dirty Vervan primary troopers wheeling a dozen or more of their wounded comrades down the hall on brass gurneys. Some of the wounded were whimpering.
"No, no," she cried out. "The west wards are full. Not that way."
Several troopers protested.
"Weren't you briefed on admittance? Show me your paperwork."
She checked the crumpled mud and blood-stained admission bills one trooper handed her.
"No, this is wrong,"
she murmured, shaking her head as she read.
"They've filled out the wrong boxes. You'll have to go back to the main triage station."
More protests. She took out her stylus and overwrote the details of the bills, signing them and scorching her seal mark on the paper with a brief flash of her signet ring.
"Back,"
she told them, with authority.
"Back that way, and they'll look after you."
The troopers retreated. Kurth turned, now hearing raised voices in Ward 12G nearby. Ward 12G had been filled with refugees from the outhabs, most of them fever-sick or undernourished. Days of careful feeding and anti-fever inoculations had improved things, and she was hoping to be able to discharge many of them back to the refugee camps in the next day or two. That would make some valuable space. She entered the arch-ceilinged ward, a long green-washed stone chamber with 700 cots. Some were screened. Other cot spaces were crowded with the families of the patients who had refused to be separated from their kin. There was a warm, cloying smell of living bodies and dirt in the air. The shouting was coming from a cot space halfway down the ward. Two of her orderlies, distinct in their red gowns from the grimy patients, were trying to calm an outhab worker as gaggles of other outhabbers looked on. The worker was a large male with no obvious injuries but a wasted, pale complexion. He was yelling and making nervous, threatening gestures at the orderlies. Kurth sighed. This wasn't the first such incident. Like far too many of the impoverished underclass, the worker was an obscura addict, hooked on the sweet opiate as a relief from his miserable shift life. Obscura was cheaper, hit for hit, than alcohol. He probably used a water pipe, or maybe an inhaler. When the invasion began, the workers had fled in hive. Now many of them were regretting leaving their opiate stashes behind in their desperation. She'd had 90 or more admitted with what at first seemed like the symptoms of gastric fever. After a few days of support and food, this had turned out to be withdrawal cramps. Strung out, Some addicts demanded medicinal drugs to ease their agonies. Others got through the withdrawal phases. Still others became violent and unreasonable. For a few, the chronic long-term users, she had been forced to prescribe ameliorating tranquilizers. Kurth stepped between her orderlies and faced the man, her hands raised in a gesture of calm.
"I'm chief surgeon," she said softly. "What's your name?"
The worker snarled something inarticulate, foam flecking his chin as his jaw worked. His eyes showed too much white.
"Your name? What's your name?"
Norand.
"How long have you been using Obscura, Norand?"
Another squeal of not words, a stammering.
"How long? It's important."
"Since I was a journeyman."
20 years at least. A lifelong abuser. There could be no reasoning here. Kurth doubted the worker would ever be able to kick the habit that was destroying his brain.
"I'll get something for you right now that will help you feel better, Norand. You just have to be calm. Can you do that?"
Drugs?
He muttered, chewing at his lips. She nodded.
"Can you be calm now?"
The worker quivered his head and sat back on his cot, panting and raking the sheets with his fingers. Kurth turned to her orderlies.
"Get me 2 shots of lamictal. Move it!"
One of the orderlies hurried off. She sent the other away to encourage patients back to their cots. There was a pause in the background noise of the ward, just for a second. Kurth had her back to the worker and realized her oh-so-very basic mistake. She turned in time to see him leaping at her, lips drawn back from his rotting teeth, a rusty clasp knife in one hand. Wondering stupidly how in the name of the Emperor he'd got that weapon into the hall unchecked, she managed to sidestep. The worker half slammed into her, and she went over backwards, overturning a water cart. The bottles smashed on the tiles. The worker, making a high-pitched whining sound, stepped over the mess while trying to keep his balance. He stabbed the knife at her, and she cried out, rolling aside and cutting her arm on the broken glass. She scrabbled to rise, expecting to feel him plant the blade in her back at any moment. Turning, she saw him choking and gagging, held in a firm chokehold from behind. Dawdon, the Tanith medical officer, had his left arm braced around the addict's neck, his right hand holding the knife wrist tightly at full length away from them both. The addict gurgled. Dawdon was completely tranquil. His hold was an expert move, just a millimeter or two of pressure away from clamping the carotid arteries, just a centimeter away from dislocating the neck. Only a brilliant medic or an imperial assassin could be that precise.
"Drop it,"
Dawdon said into the worker's ear.
"Drop it,"
the ghost repeated emphatically. Dawdon dug his thumb into a pressure point at the base of the man's palm, and the addict dropped his knife anyway. The rusty weapon clattered to the floor, and Kurth kicked it aside. Dawdon increased his chokehold for a fraction of a second, enough for the man to black out, and then dropped him face down onto an empty cot. Orderlies hurried up.
"Restrain him. Give him the lamictal, but restrain him all the same."
He turned to Kurth.
"This is a war now, you know. You should have guards in here. Things get dangerous during wars, even behind the lines."
She nodded. She was shaking.
"Thank you, Dawdon. Glad to help. I was coming to find you. Come on."
He picked up a clutch of data slates and paper forms he had dropped in order to engage the man, and he led her by the arm down the length of the ward to the exit. In the cool of the corridor outside, she paused and leaned against the stone wall, taking deep breaths.
"How long have you been working?"
"You need rest," Dawdon said.
"Is that a medical opinion?"
"No. A friend's."
She looked up at him. She had still to get the measure of this off-worlder, but she liked him. And he and his Tanith medics had been the backbone of the combat triage station.
"You've been up as long as me. I saw you working at midnight last night."
"I nap."
"You what?"
"I nap. Useful skill. I'd rate it slightly higher than suturing. I know all the excuses about there being no time for sleep. I've used them myself. Hell, I've been a doctor for a lot of years. So I learnt to nap. 10 minutes here, 5 there. In any lull. Keeps you fresh."
She shook her head and smiled.
"Where do you nap?"
she asked. He shrugged.
"I've found there's a particularly comfortable linen cupboard on the 3rd floor. You should try it. You won't be disturbed. They never change the beds in this place anyway."
That made her laugh.
"Thank you for that."
He shrugged again.
"Learn the lesson, Surgeon Kurth. Make time to nap. Trust your friends. And never turn your back on an obscure addict with a rusty knife."
I'll remember, she said, over solemnly.
They walked down the hallway together, passing two crash teams racing critical cases to the theatre.
You are coming to find me?
Hmm, he said, reminded, chiefing through the documents he was carrying.
It's nothing, really. You'll think it's stupid, but I have a thing about details.
Another lesson, if you're in the mood for more. Take care of the details, or they'll bite you in the bloody ass. He stopped, looked at her, and coloured.
My apologies. I've been in the company of foul-mouthed soldiers for too long.
Accept it. Tell me about this detail.
I was in intensive Ward 471K reviewing the situation. They are mostly inhab citizens up there, injured in the first raid. We've got blast wounds, shrapnel hits, burn cases, crush injuries. A world of bad stuff, actually. They were all in the Commercia district when the bombs fell. Specifically, he consulted the slates, carriage station C4A and the eastern barter houses. She took the slate from him.
Well?
I was checking to see if any could be discharged or at least moved to a non-intensive ward to make room. There are maybe 12 who could be shifted to the common wards.
Well, she repeated, was that it?
An administrative suggestion?
No, no, he said, and leafed to another sheet. I told you the sort of injuries we were getting up there, mostly from the shelling, a few from panic stampedes, but there were two others, both in comas, critical. I was wondering why they had gunshot wounds.
What?
She snatched the slates and studied them closely.
Small caliber. Maybe a needle gun. Easy to mistake it for shrapnel wounding.
It says glass lacerations here. The station canopies all blew out, and
I know a needle gun wound when I see it, and I'm seeing over a dozen shared between the two of them. They were shot at close range. I checked the records. 12 others were brought in from the same site with identical wounds, but they were all dead on arrival.
This is the Commercier?
A sub-transit station, C7D, not actually hit by direct shelling, so the records state. But there were at least 20 bodies recovered there.
She read the forms again and then looked up at him.
You're thinking what I'm thinking, aren't you?
He smiled.
Hundreds of thousands, dead and dying, all needing us, and I'm worried about just two of them. I shouldn't care how they were hurt, just that they need me.
She paused.
Yes, I am thinking that, but...
Ah,
but... Useful word. Why were they shot? Who was opening fire on helpless citizens in the middle of a raid?
Despite her hours on duty, Anna Kurth was suddenly awake again. Dorden was right. This was small compared to the scale of the general human misery in Vervenhive. But it could not go unmarked. The Scholem Medicalis had trained her to value every single life individually.
Vervenhive is being murdered, she said. Most of the murderers are out there, wearing ochre armor. Some, I have to say, are sitting pretty around the chat tables in house command. But there is another, and we will find him.
Gaunt straightened his cap, smoothed the folds of a clean leather jacket, and left his escort of 6 Tanith troops at the elevator assembly. The escort, led by Kafran, stood easy, gazing around themselves at the lofty, gleaming architecture of the upper spine. None of them had ever expected to see the inside of a hive's noble level.
Even the Fething lift has a carpet,
Trooper Kokoa hissed. Gaunt looked round. Stay here. Behave yourselves. The ghosts nodded, then congregated around an ornamental fountain where foamy water bubbled from conches held by gilt nymphs into a lily-skinned green pool. Some of the ghost guard rested their lasguns against the marble lip. Gaunt smiled to see Kafran check that the seat of his pants was clean before sitting on the marble. So out of place, he thought, as he left them with a last look. 6 dirty dog soldiers, fresh from battle, in the middle of the serene vaults of the worthy and powerful. He paced down the length of the promenade, his shiny boots hushing into the blue carpeting. The air was perfumed, and gentle plainsong echoed from hidden speakers. The vault above was glass, supported by thin traceries of iron. Trees, real trees, grew in the centre beds of the long hall, and small, bright songbirds fluttered through the branches. This is the privilege of power, Gaunt thought. The great doors, crafted from single pieces of some vast tree, stood before him, the crest of House Chass raised in varnished bas-relief on their front. Ivy traces clad the walls to either side, and small blue flowers budded from fruit trees in the avenue that led to the doorway. He took out the token seal and fitted it into a knurled slot in the door lock. The great doors swung inward silently. There was a fanfare of choral voices. He stepped inside, entering a high vault that was lit blue by the light falling through stained glass orioles high above. The walls were mosaics, depicting incidents and histories that were unknown to him. The Chass crest was repeated at intervals in the mosaic.
"Welcome, honored visitor, to the enclave of House Chass. Your use of a token emblem signifies you to be an invited and worthy guest. Please wait in the anteroom, and refreshments will be sent while his lordship is informed of your arrival."
The servitor's voice was smooth and warm, and it issued from the air itself. The great doors hushed closed behind Gaunt. He removed his cap and gloves and set them on a teak side table. A second later, the inner doors opened and three figures entered. Two were house guards dressed in body armor, identical to that of the one who had accosted Gaunt outside the Privy Council. They had satin shrouds over their hand weapons and nodded to him stiffly. The third, a female servitor, her enhancement implants and plugs made of inlaid gold, carried a tray of refreshments on long, silver-jointed arms, which supplemented her natural limbs. She stopped before Gaunt.
"Water, jolique, berry wine, sweetmeats. Please, help yourself, worthy guest. Or, if nothing pleases you, tell me, and I will attend your special needs."
"This is fine," Gaunt said. "A measure of that local liquor." Holding the salver with her extra arms, the female servitor gracefully poured Gaunt a shot of jalique into a crystal glass and handed it to him. He took it with a nod, and the servitor withdrew to the side of the room. Gaunt sipped the drink, thoughtfully. He was beginning to wonder why he had come. It was clear there was a universe of difference between himself and Chass. What could they have in common?
"To be here, you must have been invited, but I do not know you."
Gaunt turned and faced a young noblewoman who had entered from the far side of the anteroom. She wore a long gown of yellow silk with a fur stole and an ornate headdress of silver wire and jewels. She was almost painfully beautiful, and Gaunt saw cunning intelligence in her perfect face. He nodded respectfully with a click of his heels.
"I'm Gaunt, lady."
"The off-world commissar?"
"One of them. Several of my stripe arrived with the guard."
"But you're the famous one,
Ibram Gaunt.
They say the people's hero, Cowl, was beside himself with rage when he heard the famous Gaunt was coming to Vervenhive."
"Do they?" The girl circled him. Gaunt remained facing the way he was.
"Indeed they do. War heroes Cowl can manage to stomach, so they report, but a commissar war hero. Famous for his actions on Balhaut, Fortis Binary, the Menazoid Clasp, Monthax, too much for Cowl. You might eclipse him. Vervenhive is large, but there can be only one famous, dashing commissar hero, can't there?"
"Perhaps. I'm not interested in rivalry." "So, you're versed in recent military history, lady?"
"No, but my maids are."
She smiled dangerously.
"Your maids have taken an interest in my record."
"Deeply. You and your, what was it they said, your scruffy, courageous ghost warriors? Apparently, they are so much more exciting than the starchy Volpone Bluebloods."
"That I can vouch for," he replied. Though she was lovely, he had already had enough of her superior manner and courtly flirting. Responding to such things could get a man shot. "I've six scruffy, courageous ghost warriors right outside, if you'd like me to introduce them to your maids," he smiled.
"Or to you." She paused. Outrage tried to escape her composed expression. She contained it well.
"What do you want, Gaunt?"
she asked instead, her tone harder.
"Lord Chass summoned me."
"My father?"
"I thought so." "That would make you..."
"Merity Chass, of House Chass."
Gaunt bowed gently again. He took another sip of the drink.
"What do you know of my father?"
she asked crisply, still circling like a gourd cock in a mating ritual.
"Master of one of the nine noble houses of Vervenhive. One of the three who opposed General Sturm's tactical policy. One who took an interest in my counter-proposals. An ally, I suppose."
"Don't use him. Don't dare use him," she said fiercely.
"Use him? Lady,
don't play games. Chass is one of the most powerful noble houses and one of the oldest, but it is part of the minority. Crow and Anko hold power and opposition, Anko especially. My father is what they call a liberal. He has lofty ideals and is a generous and honest man. But he is also guileless, vulnerable. A crafty political agent could use his honesty and betray him. It has happened before.
Lady Chess, I have no designs on your father's position. He summoned me here. I have no idea what he wants. I am a warmaker, a leader of soldiers. I'd rather cut off my right arm than get involved in house politics. She thought about this.
Promise me, Gaunt. Promise me you won't use him. Lord Anko would love to see my noble house and its illustrious lineage overthrown.
He studied her face. She was serious about this, guileless, to use her own word. I'm no intriguer. Leave that to Cowell. Simple, honest promises are something I can do. They are what soldiers live by. So, I promise you, lady.
Swear it.
I swear on the life of the beloved Emperor and the light of the Ray of Hope. She swallowed, looked away, and then said,
Come with me.
With her bodyguards trailing at a respectful distance, she led Gaunt out of the anteroom, along a hallway where soft, gauzy draperies billowed in a cool breeze, and out onto a terrace. The terrace projected from the outer wall of the main spine and was covered by a dedicated refractor shield. They were about a kilometer up. Below, the vast sprawl of Vervenhive spread out to the distant bulk of the curtain wall. Above them rose the peak of the spine, glossed in ice, overarched by the huge bowl of the crackling shield. The terrace was an ornamental cybernetic garden. Mechanical leaf forms grew and sprouted in the ordered beds, and bionic vines self-replicated in zigzag patterns of branches to form a dwarf orchard. Metal bees and delicate paper-winged butterflies whirred through the silvery stems and iron branches. Oil-ripe fruit, black like sloes, swung from blossom joints on the swaying mechanical tree limbs. Lord Heimlich Chass, dressed in a gardener's robes, slight marks of oil sap on his cuffs and apron, moved down the rows of artificial plants, deadheading brass-petaled flowerheads with a pair of laser secateurs and pruning back the sprays of aluminium roses. He looked up as his daughter led the commissar over.
I was hoping you would come, Lord Chass said.
I was delayed by events, Gaunt said.
Of course.
Chass nodded and gazed out at the south curtain for a moment.
A bad night. Your men survived?
Most of them. War is war.
I was informed of your actions at Haas West. Vervenhive owes you already, Commissar.
Gaunt shrugged. He looked around the metal garden.
I have never seen anything like this, he said, honestly. A private indulgence. Haas Chass built its success on servitors, cogitators, and mechanical development. I make working machines for the Imperium. It pleases me to let them evolve in natural forms here, with no purpose other than their own life.
Merity stood back from the pair.
I'll leave you alone, then, she said.
Chass nodded, and the girl stalked away between the wire vines and the tin blooms. You have a fine daughter, Lord.
Yes, I have. My heir. No sons. She has a gift for mechanical structures that quite dazzles me. She will lead Haas Chass into the next century.
He paused, snicked a rusting flowerhead off into his waist-slung sack, and sighed.
If there is a next century for Vervenhive.
This war will be won by the Imperial force, Lord. I have no doubt. Chass smiled round at the Commissar.
Spoken like a true political animal, Commissar Gaunt.
It wasn't meant to be a platitude.
Nor did I take it as one. But you are a political animal, aren't you, Gaunt?
I am a colonel of the Imperial Guard, a warrior for the Almighty Emperor, praise his name. My politics extend as far as raising troop morale. No further. Chass nodded.
Walk with me, he said.
They moved through a grove of platinum trees, heavy with brass oranges. Frills of wire-lace creepers were soldered to the burnished trunks. Beyond the grove, crossing iron lawns that creaked under their footsteps, they walked down a row of bushes with broad, inlaid leaves of soft bronze.
I suppose my daughter has been bending your ear with warnings about my liberal ways.
You are correct, Lord. Chass laughed.
She is hugely protective of me. She thinks I'm vulnerable.
She said as much.
Indeed.
Let me show you this.
Chas led Gaunt into a maze of hedges. The hedgerows crackled with energized life, like veils of illusions.
Fractal topiary, Chas said proudly. Mathematical structures generated by the stem forms of the cogitators planted here.
It is a wonder. Lord Chas looked around at Gaunt.
It leaves you cold, doesn't it, Gaunt?
Cold is too strong a word. It leaves me puzzled. Why am I here?
You are an unusual officer, Gaunt. I have studied your record files carefully.
So have the housemaids, Gaunt said. Chas snorted, taking a cropping wand from his belt. He began to use it to shape the glowing fractal hedges nearby.
For different reasons, I assure you. The maids want husbands. I want friends. Your record shows me that you are a surprisingly moral creature.
Does it? Gaunt watched the noble trim the light buds of the bush, disinclined to speak further.
True to the imperial cause, to the crusade, but not always true to your direct superiors when those motives clash. With Javier on Menazoid Epsilon, for example. With our own General Sturm on Voltimand. You seek your own way, and like a true commissar, you are never negligent in punishing those of your own side who counter the common good.
Gaunt looked out across the vast hive below them. Another sentence or two, and you'll be speaking treason, Lord Chas.
And who will hear me? A man who roots out treason professionally? If I speak treason, Gaunt, you can kill me here.
I hope we can avoid that, Lord, Gaunt said quietly.
So do I. From the incident in the Privy Council the other day, I understand you do not agree with General Sturm's tactical plan.
Gaunt's measured nod spoke for him.
We have something in common, then. I don't agree with House Sondar's leadership either. Sondar controls Crow, and Anko is its lapdog. They will lead us to annihilation.
Such machinations are far above me, Lord Chas, Gaunt pointed out diplomatically. Chas wandered the hedge again. He was forming a perfect imperial eagle from the blister tendrils of light.
But we are both affected. Bad policy and bad leadership will destroy this hive. You and I will suffer then.
Gaunt cleared his throat. With respect, is there a point to this, Lord Chas?
Perhaps. Perhaps not. I wanted to speak with you, Gaunt, get the measure of you. I wanted to understand your inner mind and see if there was any kindred flame there. I have a great responsibility to Vervenhive, greater than the leadership of this noble house.
You wouldn't understand, and I'm not about to explain it.
Trust me.
Gaunt said nothing.
I will preserve the life of this hive to my dying breath, and beyond it, if necessary. I need to know who I can count on. You may go now. I will send for you again in time. Perhaps.
Gaunt nodded and turned away. The imperial eagle in the fractal topiary was now complete.
Gaunt.
He turned back. Lord Chas reached into his waist sack and pulled out a rose. It was perfect, made of steel, just budding and faintly edged with rust. The silver stem was stiff, and aluminium thorns split out of it. Chas held it out.
Wear this for honor.
Gaunt took the metal rose and hooked it into the lapel of his jacket, over his heart. He nodded. For honor, I'll wear anything. Chas stood alone as Gaunt threaded his way out of the metal garden and departed. Chas remained stationary in thought for a long time.
Father?
Merity appeared out of the brass orange grove.
What did you make of him?
An honorable man. Slightly stiff, but not shy. He has spirit and courage.
Undoubtedly.
Can we trust him?
What do you think?
Merity paused, stroking the fractal blooms absently.
It's your choice, master of our house.
Heimlich Chas laughed.
It is. But you like him? That's important. You asked me to keep you informed.
I like him, yes.
Chas nodded. He took the amulet from the waste sack where it had been all the time, buried in the garden scraps. He turned it over in his hands. It writhed and clicked.
We'll know soon enough,
he told his daughter. Day 31 passed without major incident. Shelling whined back and forth between the wall defenders and the waiting Zeuchan army. At dawn on the 32nd day, the second Zeuchan assault began.